Welcome back, Chico listeners. I'm your host, Natalie Hansen, and we're back for another show of the KZFR Peace and Social Justice Program here in beautiful Chico, California. And I'm so glad to join with you all today. I'm in the midst of the summer, and we have a pretty packed show this time around. We are going to be talking quite a bit about surveillance systems and policing, but I just welcome you all back and thank you for paying attention to local news, for being invested in local coverage, and it just really makes a difference when our community really wants to stay informed and is very supportive of the different ways of reporting and journalism that can keep us informed and also keeping each other in the loop and working together as a community to stay informed about the things that affect everyone, not only here in our own neighborhoods, but also throughout the North State and California. It really means so much to see our community so focused on this and taking care of each other. So today we are going to just jump right in on this story, which published on July 25th. I think it's important to get right to this right now, and then we will touch on some more news that has come out over the last month, some issues that we talked about in the last show. But I really wanted to get right to returning to surveillance systems and just digging deeper into what we're seeing, not just in our own city, but in how city governments across the state are handling these technologies and their application, especially when we consider sharing of data with federal agencies at a time of extremely heightened federal enforcement, use of ICE and Border Patrol, and detaining many residents and citizens across the U.S. So we have here this article titled, Chico PD Granted ICE Border Patrol Access to Its ALPR Data. This was published July 25th on chicosol.org, and this is by Elias Myers. And it is a criminal justice and policing story. And I just really hope you'll settle in to hear about the background behind the reporting here. So the story finds that Chico PD said it has shut off license plate reader data sharing that, until July 8th, may have been in violation of California state law. There are two California laws which restrict or prohibit the sharing of ALPR data beyond this state. There is Senate Bill 34, and that says local law enforcement can only share collected data with California agencies, and Senate Bill 54, the Values Act, which bars local law enforcement from assisting in federal immigration actions. Part of the reason we're here is 2 weeks after Chico Sol News requests the public records related to the department's automated license plate reader data sharing program, which from here on out we'll call ALPR, Chico PD said it did stop sharing that data with federal and out-of-state agencies. So in a recent interview, the story says Chief of Police Billy Aldridge indicated at one point he was unaware federal and out-of-state agencies had access to the city's ALPR system. He was interviewed July 22nd, and he says, quote, as we started producing the information for this PRA, we found out, quote, holy cow, we're sharing with these people, and actually when it was set up, we shouldn't have been sharing outside of California or with the federal agencies. He says, we immediately shut it off. So this story is saying that as they were producing information for the PRA for what Chico Sol is requesting, Aldridge is saying that's how the department found out they were sharing outside of California with federal agencies. So civil rights attorneys, according to the article, said the data sharing may have violated the 10-year-old SB 34 and 8-year-old SB 54. Nick Hidalgo, who is a senior staff attorney at the ACLU of Northern California, said, quote, the law is crystal clear that a law enforcement agency in the state of California is not allowed to share ALPR information with any law enforcement agency outside of the state, and that includes federal agencies. Hidalgo also called ALPRs a dangerous and invasive surveillance technology. Now let's note here, Chico PD has said, according to the article, it could not yet provide documentation showing the sharing shutoff alleged. It also said it has begun a full audit of the data sharing. Let's stop here for a moment and recognize that there are other cities that have also been accused of and criticized for continuing to share this data collected largely through vehicles and surveillance of those vehicles for several years now, even while those laws were intact. For example, at Vallejo Sun, there's an article by Ryan Geller back in 2024 stating Vallejo police were still illegally sharing ALPR data out of state as surveillance board was mulling their contract renewal. So in that year, Vallejo PD was continuing to share the ALPR data with other out-of-state agencies, including Houston Police Department, and that could have been an ongoing violation of California law. By the way, that city contracts with Flock Safety, which we're going to talk more about, this company which provides a large selection of camera surveillance equipment to many cities and police departments. Vallejo in particular has had a contract with Flock Safety for ALPR cameras. They've also had contracts in place of varying lengths, including for gunshot detection technology. I wrote an article just last week titled Vallejo Surveillance Board, that was in July 2021 this year. Vallejo Surveillance Board was reviewing police monitoring of Flock camera footage. So there's been growing concern about Flock safety and its surveillance cameras across the state and really across the country. So Vallejo's contract for those ALPR cameras is under review by the Vallejo City Council, because they were about to approve almost $500,000 to continue that contract underway. So that is under review, as many locals have spoken about the use of Flock and their concerns about surveillance. So this is happening in other cities. Let's return to Chico. But I just wanted to provide some context about other cities dealing with this and how some cities have also continued to share data, perhaps in violation of these laws. Chico PD, in response to a June 22nd Public Records Act request, provided records that showed data sharing with many federal and out-of-state law enforcement agencies. There were records as recent as July 7 from the Motorola ALPR dashboard, showing 20 federal agencies and more than 80 out-of-state law enforcement agencies which had access to Chico's data. Those agencies which were able to access the data include ICE Enforcement and Removal Operations, ICE Homeland Security Investigations, the U.S. Border Patrol, and a military police department at a Southern California U.S. Marine base. Chico PD gave ICE access to this data since February 28, 2024, according to MOUs updated through Chico Soul through public records requests. So the chief of police told Chico Soul the system is nearly 2 years old and was set up solely for the purpose of criminal investigations and to help in locating missing persons and stolen property. Aldridge said, quote, "It was never intended for any kind of immigration purposes. We don't abide by any kind of immigration enforcement because we have SB 54, the Values Act. The sharing with out-of-state and federal agencies was in line with Chico PD policy, even though the California laws were in effect." Aldridge said, "When we initiated the ALPR system and started allowing access to it, it was through an MOU process. It was an agreement that they would only use it for criminal investigations and there would be no immigration enforcement at all." The chief said an internal audit is underway that shows federal agencies accessed ALPR records, but the audit does not yet show data was retrieved by those agencies. But it did find that we've had access by federal agencies on multiple occasions, but so far no sharing of data that has happened, Aldridge said. The plates they were looking for did not pop up in our system. However, he noted there are several million records in the system and many are still unaudited. I highly recommend looking at the article live on the website itself, because you're going to see some digital interactives. You're going to see a map of Chico PD's ALPR data sharing network, which Elias Myers, the reporter, made, showing agencies with access to the ALPR detections, and you can see where those are originating from. Then there's another map which shows locations of all of the ALPR cameras in Chico. Very useful to see where those cameras are located. Chief Aldridge told Chico Soul he is concerned about the full audit. Quote, "It's definitely something that concerns me. Did we do something that we need to take ownership of?" He said, "If there are legal issues from that, I'll refer to the city attorney." Chico Police Department has 27 active stationary Motorola brand ALPR cameras. They are capable of collecting data from passing vehicles, and they capture more than just license plate numbers. Many of them are positioned near major roadways entering and leaving Chico. The department has plans to install two additional cameras in the near future. These cameras are capable of identifying the make and model of a vehicle, as well as bumper stickers and images of a vehicle's passengers. This is according to Jennifer Pinsoff, a staff attorney at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, a digital civil rights organization. She called it a scary mass surveillance machine and noted the state attorney general's office has commented on similar practices in other cities, as we've mentioned about Vallejo and other cities. She said, "It's pretty clear that Chico's in violation of the law. This data is aggregated into a large searchable database where law enforcement can trace a vehicle's movements months after the data has been captured." Pinsoff said, "This data can be compiled with other data to reveal more and more about people, where they go, where you sleep at night, how they commute to work. This has also been discussed in other cities where people say they are very concerned about the fact that there are movements, there are patterns of movement throughout cities, between counties. The times in which they do it, when their pattern varies, are all traceable, trackable. And when that data is out there, they can't be sure who is looking at the data and for what purpose. In Chico Police Department's Policy Manual 449.5B1, the department allows data sharing with Oregon, Nevada, Arizona, and federal agencies. Once an MOU is reached between Chico and the receiving department, out-of-state and federal agencies have entered successful data sharing MOUs with Chico PD. The chief said it was within our policy that we would share with an agency that would request an MOU. That policy has since been pulled. New policy is being released here shortly and pretty much removes the piece about sharing, he added. Only inside California agencies will have access. He also said he was unsure where Chico PD's data sharing policy originated. He said if it was Lexapol language or if it was our language, we're still working through that to figure out how that happened. Lexapol, by the way, is a distributor of law enforcement policy manuals contracted by the city of Chico. At the time of publication, this part of the department's policy manual permitting ALPR sharing with out-of-state and federal agencies remains live on the city's website. The story also notes how many other cities are having these privacy concerns and discussing the use of and sharing of ALPR data. Nationwide, ALPR technologies are being reviewed. For example, on July 15, the city of Los Angeles, like Sin Cities in South Bay Area, discontinued the three-year contract with ALPR provider Flock Safety. Chico criminal defense attorney Elizabeth Latimer said the technology recently helped Chico police recover her stolen vehicle quickly. Officers were able to track the car to Williams about 5.5 hours after she reported it stolen. Although she was happy she could quickly recover her car, she admits she was frightened by the precision and reach of the tracking technology and its implications for privacy. So, by the way, this story was made possible not only by the reporter, but by editor Leslie Layton and other work by other reporters and editors. This is why local news and support of it is so important. And you can also look at the comments on this story and how concerned in general readers seem to be with the findings from this reporting. I'm sure this won't be the last time we hear about this information, and expect to hear more from the police department and if there will be a review by the city council over this. The city, of course, does not have a surveillance advisory board. Peace to Social Justice is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Dana Campbell Law, providing compassionate, comprehensive, trusted estate planning and administration. Dana, her daughter Tara, and their staff also offer healthcare directives, conservatorships, and special needs trusts with decades of experience to help protect your family's assets and peace of mind. Prepare for tomorrow and your family's future by visiting danacampbelllaw.com. And by Duffy's Tavern, on the corner of 4th and Main in downtown Chico since 1989. Duffy's is open 7 days a week from 5 p.m. to 2 a.m. Duffy's Tavern is Chico's home for craft cocktails made with fresh squeezed juices and premium spirits, and live Irish music with the Pub Scouts every Friday from 5 to 7 p.m. If you enjoy this program, you can please now go to kzfr.org and tip this show. And now back to the program. Thank you for sticking with us through reporting on policing and surveillance. I would love to hear more from readers and listeners if they have concerns about these technologies and about mass surveillance throughout communities and what they've also witnessed or been concerned about. We'd love to hear from you. Let's move on now to a story about power, energy, how shutoffs impact different people, and about distribution of resources, really. So first, we're going to look at a story by CalMatters, which was published earlier this month, and then a local feature story by reporter Chris Hutton. So CalMatters reported on July 21, California restricts utility shutoffs as there was a dangerous heat wave across the state. We saw the fallout in many communities, how utilities handle the situation. This story was reported by Alejandro Lazo at CalMatters. California bars utilities, the reporter notes, from cutting off power to customers who fall behind on their bills when it's hot outside. Losing power in some rural areas, as many of us are aware, can also mean losing water, and having no way to cool down can be very dangerous, even deadly, when hot weather spans several days. California regulators more than a year ago said rules protecting delinquent customers from power shutoffs during heat waves were not strong enough and ordered the state's largest utilities to come up with better safeguards. The utilities unveiled their plan in December, but their proposals barely changed anything, according to this commission. finding their proposal does not offer sufficient health protections for ratepayers. As another stretch of dangerous heat has now gripped the state, this commission, the California Public Utilities Commission, made its own stronger rules, lowering the temperature at which utilities must stop shedding enough power to customers from 100 to 90 degrees, and order utilities to adopt a more protective, region-specific heat standard within 6 months. The article notes a record heat wave which took place 2 years ago, which is on record as the hottest July in California history. Consumer group Utility Reform Network asked the commission to revisit its definition of extreme heat at that time. The group's emergency request argued, quote, heat kills more people directly than any other weather-related hazard. The rules already barred electric utilities from disconnecting residential customers for non-payment if those temperatures soared above 100 degrees within 72 hours. The group said a single statewide threshold doesn't account for how differently Californians experience heat depending on where they live. It could be vastly different in many different counties, and even different parts of those counties, as many of us who live in the North State are aware. The utilities propose using CalHeatScore, a newly created state tool which scores heat by zip code using local health data and historic impacts, taking into account data on nearby cooling centers as well as the number of children and seniors who can be much more susceptible to extreme heat. But the utilities proposed setting the cutoff threshold at level 3 and keeping 100 degrees as the backstop when it wasn't available. Utilities said they could not meet this deadline because CalHeatScore's own data system, run by the state's Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment, was not yet ready to support them. So why does this all matter? This week, the commission rejected the utilities' proposal, siding with advocates. The path utilities proposed would be no different than prior practice. It noted the extreme heat threshold is already below 100 degrees in 41 of California's 58 counties. Now, let's look at this. A 90-degree day might be routine in dry inland cities such as Bakersfield or Fresno, but such temperatures could be quite dangerous in coastal or mountain communities where fewer homes have air conditioning and people are less acclimated to the heat. San Francisco, for instance, defines heat as extreme when temperatures climb above 85 degrees. The far northwest county of Del Norte could think extreme heat means anything above 76.8 degrees, according to the commission. The commission wrote in its resolution, a single threshold temperature level needs to be more protective of residents in areas of the state which are not accustomed to high temperatures. Last December, the major investor-owned utilities together argued extending protections to consumers at lower heat scores would halt disconnections too often, deepen unpaid balances, and add costs without a health benefit. Those utility companies said the 90-degree threshold was overbroad. The protections would apply only to shutoffs for unpaid bills. They would not prevent outages caused by equipment failures, wildfire prevention shutoffs, or other emergencies. Nevertheless, advocates say the changes are important. But when electricity is shut off to a home, it can have a sort of cascading effect of problems on tenants, according to Jason Zeller, attorney with the Utility Consumers Action Network. If tenants don't have electric service, they can be subject to eviction. If they have children, they can lose child custody. PG&E spokesperson Adrian Moore says, disconnection is a last resort at PG&E, only after multiple attempts to contact customers and offer payment plans and assistance programs. But the commission's independent public advocates office pressed for stronger protections throughout the process, formally opposing the utility's plan. Director Linda Sarazawa said, the vote will provide customers with protection that takes effect when they need it most. So I wanted to set the stage with this article and move on to reporting which took place just the next 2 days. This article is titled 4 Days in County Without Power. And this story, I think, will hit very close to home for many of us, including those of us who have spent time living in Oroville, including in certain parts of Oroville where the heat and the shutoffs can come together in a really devastating way. So this article is written by Chris Hutton. It's titled 4 Days in County Without Power, published July 23rd, cheekofsoul.org. It's a really beautiful piece set up, opening with Justin Bishop painting a picture of what's taking place for him. Justin Bishop was playing his guitar inside a mobile home in his Oroville senior living community. I recommend just reading the article and sitting with it, and the reporter being allowed to note that even he was sweating. It's because it was already 90 degrees. It was 3 p.m. and Bishop was 75. It was his second day without power after PG&E cut it off July 20. He said it was because he didn't pay his bill of $1,259. It's been climbing for months. He said his bills have been high because he had to run 3 space heaters after a gas leak drained the propane tank while he was in hospital. For Bishop, staying cool in the summer months and warm in the winter is crucial for his health. He has a medical condition where nerves near his brain and spinal cord are damaged, resulting in pain and numbness in his hands and feet. Extreme temperature makes his condition worse, and he's not on a payment plan for PG&E. Recently, this commission, as we discussed, barred utility companies from shutting off customer power if the temperature exceeds 90 degrees for 3 days. And Paul Moreno, a spokesperson, has said safety is the top priority and shutting off power is a last resort. He said typically 2 notices are sent. Now, Chico Sol says it was able to verify Bishop received a 2-day notice, but Bishop couldn't remember if he received another one. Moreno also told Chico Sol, PG&E's focus is on implementing the new approved temperature threshold for disconnections and helping customers stay safe and connected through payment plans, financial assistance programs, and other support resources. He said PG&E has given about $35 million of a committed $50 million fund to help customers who aren't able to pay their bills. Also added, there are several programs that can help low-income customers, such as the Baseline Plan, and there are also local and county plans to help. However, Bishop said he thought it was being handled by such a program. Now, as many of us are aware, temperatures exceeding 90 degrees for prolonged periods can be very dangerous, especially for elderly adults and people with chronic health issues. In the United States, extreme heat kills more than 700 people per year, which is according to the Centers for Disease Control. On the day Bishop's power was cut off, it peaked around 92 degrees, and the reporter notes, when he visited, the temperature climbed above 100 degrees. Since May, Oroville has experienced 48 days above 90 degrees this year, according to the National Weather Service. Bishop's former at-home registered nurse called this a, quote, life and death situation. He already struggles with his blood pressure and a lack of sodium, which can both be deadly, especially in the heat. The reporter said he checked the weather forecast while Bishop mentioned the long financial support forms he has had to fill out and the long wait times on the phone, very little ever getting resolved. It wasn't going to drop below 90 degrees for the foreseeable future. The reporter notes how even a piece of paper in his pocket was soaked in sweat. Bishop said he doesn't sleep until late at night when he can open the windows and let the cool wind bring the temperature down. He is awoken by a suffocating blanket of heat around noon as the temperature builds inside the mobile home. Bishop awoke to a power cutoff on a Monday. He said, I woke up and there was no radio and no lights to turn on, and I thought, uh-oh. So Bishop called a friend who was concerned about his health, went to check on Bishop, and brought the reporter. The reporter had ice water inside an air-conditioned car outside Bishop's home, and he noticed Bishop's dog, Holly. She was injured recently and had a slight limp when she walked from her bowl of water to the couch, where a single cushion was removed to make it easier for her to get up. Bishop coughed throughout the conversation. He had a table covered in bills and notices and an oxygen concentrator to help with pulmonary issues. Without electricity, it can't run. He receives $1,200 through Social Security each month, but his rent is $786, could go up soon, and that takes up most of the income. Bishop doesn't eat out. He has frozen foods, which are now spoiled in the fridge that was shut off. And by the time the reporter left, he still hadn't eaten. His truck hasn't worked since an engine failure. He said it was too costly to repair, so he borrows a neighbor's car in the senior living park. Last summer in August, PG&E shut his power off then because of late payments. It wasn't turned back on for 10 days until his at-home nurse called Adult Protective Services, which then paid the bill and brought Bishop water and food within 2 hours. This time, though, a friend who called Adult Protective Services told Bishop the situation is an ongoing issue and APS needs 10 days to investigate. Last year, Bishop was having dire health challenges and wasn't able to play guitar for years. But the reporter notes Bishop was able to this time. There's a video of him playing a song Across the Divide, and he also talked about a song he wrote, Tomato Town. Bishop reflected on traveling to more than 40 countries playing old Western music. He discussed his arthritis and said of his days touring, carrying heavy guitars and banjos, music is his passion. And he talked about the various instruments he has, how important it is to be able to play music, and listed the places he traveled to. South America, Central America, Mexico, Canada, Africa, Europe, Eastern Germany. Then he came to Sacramento for about 8 years to care for his mother until she passed at the age of 95. He eventually had financial issues and came to Oroville. Since the multi-year period he couldn't play, he is regaining his musical prowess and has even played at a recent celebration of life for a friend. But he's really impacted by the loss of power. He can't charge his phone or play his CDs. A television his friend gave him sits powerless in the corner of the room. He does try to read the New Yorker often. When the reporter asked what his plan is now that adult services hasn't stepped in, Bishop continued to talk about the life he's led, of his times traveling, and his enjoyment of the music that brought him through it. Bishop continues to be in this place in Oroville, and it is not clear several days later if anything has taken place. I guess we'll see if there's been an update soon from this story. This story is a more first-person feature, and hopefully we'll have an update soon. But I think it really just touches on the suffocating experience of living without power. I will share that I've lived in a mobile home in Oroville before, and that was only with a swamp cooler, and it was going through a summer that was particularly brutal during one of the drought years, some may remember. And there's something about that heat that you never forget, and your ability to function in daily life is so hindered. And this was while I have been a young person, an able-bodied person, but I've seen the impacts it had on elderly people in my life, and especially those with chronic health issues. And I think we'll be hearing more before the summer's up about how the state is going to be addressing this issue if we continue to hear from local communities about how it has impacted them. Thanks for listening, and we will be right back.
The start of a new year is the perfect time for a fresh start. Start the year off right by getting rid of things you just don't need and making room for better things. Declutter and make a difference by donating your car to KZFR. It's easy, free, and your contribution supports the programs you love. Visit kzfr.org/car donation to learn more, or call our office at 530-895-0131.
Welcome back to our next segment, where we consider the next stage in how the city is managing different sites for unhoused residents in Chico. And I want to first touch on an article released July 22nd regarding the alternative camping site, which of course is at Eaton and Cohasset Roads in Chico. And then we will look at the newest update that came out regarding the site and what the residents at that site and then others throughout the city are concerned about given the city's policies. So this article by Yu Cheng Tang, which was published July 22nd, takes a look at what folks at the alternative camping site have been discussing since the city announced this plan to shut it down in January 2027. Elizabeth Isaacs, who has been living there for quite some time, was interviewed about the situation, telling the reporter, "I try not to think about it. I just don't have a plan yet." She mentioned the heat, the lack of shade, what residents often face at the tents, and less likely to come out and spend time with others, leading to more isolation. The alternative site is still enclosed by a chain link fence with the ground covered by gravel. Designated residents live in tents within 20 by 20 foot spaces. The site has basic amenities alone, a few portable toilets, a water hose, two barbecue grills, and a dumpster. Now, of course, many of us have been paying attention to the alternative site and what happens with it regarding the years-long underway Warren v. Chico settlement agreement, because this required providing a location for people who just don't qualify to be the Torres Community Shelter or, of course, the Genesis Pallet Shelter, which I think most of us are familiar with. Now, this settlement agreement is set to expire in January 2027, so more on that in a moment. Now, in practice, this site also accepted people who, quote, refused to stay in either shelter. Charles Withhune on the North State Shelter team, which provides weekly shower service for residents at the site, said at one point more than 50 people were there. Seven remaining residents at the time told Chico Soul that they feared they'll be pushed back to the streets once the site closes. Most have lived unhoused for more than 5 years, and so adapting to a managed shelter environment with limited space and more rules could be very challenging for them. And this has been backed up by others who often work closely with unhoused populations with varying degrees of medical and personal needs. The 2025 point in time survey found 25% of participants reported not using shelters because they feel overwhelmed being around so many people. 18% said they felt unsafe. And so residents say they would rather camp in places such as a church parking lot, along the creek in Lower Bidwell Park, or elsewhere than stay in a shelter. And some housing advocates predicted the site's closure would leave at least some of its former residents back on Chico streets and in other public spaces once again, vulnerable to sweeps and perhaps harkening a return to the policy which once existed of sweeping one site, people are displaced, sweeping another site, people are displaced, which I know some of us are well aware of. And I was present for a lot of those situations in 2020 and 2021 before the settlement agreement began. With Yoon said, he understood some of the reluctance to enter shelters and voiced concerns about what he calls ineffective ways of tackling homelessness. He said, if the alternate site is closed down, and then if we don't provide a new place for the campers to live in, such a tiny home or some sort of managed campground situation, we are going to be spending a lot more taxpayer dollars on more sweeps or jail. The site has long been a controversial subject since it opened in February 2023. There has been hostility towards homelessness expressed and extended to the site itself. In 2023, when a Chico Soul reporter visited the site, someone in a passing car fired a BB gun at a group of people at the site. As a result, even residents there who may be viewed as troublemakers worry about their own personal safety and the security of their belongings. They said many problems were caused by unauthorized campers and complained the site's living conditions are still inadequate and largely unchanged for a long time. With the city free to forge a new direction as the settlement agreement expires, it will shut down the site and stresses the importance of accountability on the part of unhoused people and enforcing ordinances banning public camping, which have long been the subject of this topic. At a May City Council meeting, Eric Gustafson, assistant city manager, said a high utilizer service resistant team would be formed to work with the people who remain on the streets after the site closes. The responsibilities of that team would include enforcing anti-campaign ordinances and cleaning Chico's public spaces. He said, we've deployed a whole lot of compassion, and I think there really has to be a time for accountability. It's those folks who continue to behave badly, break the rules, and don't want to get into the program. There's going to have to be some accountability associated with it, too. A resident at the site, Timothy Shelley, said once it closes, he could be arrested for sleeping on the streets during law enforcement sweeps. He was cited 3 or 4 times in the past for setting up a tent in a public space before he moved to the site. Shelley said it shouldn't be a crime to be homeless. He said the government should not criminalize people just because they are down on their luck or don't have enough money to pay rent or just can't get a house. Shelley once stayed at Genesis for a few hours but found he did not like it there. He compared it to being in an internment camp. So he returned to the streets before police officers persuaded him to come to the alternative camping site. Although the site is not much better than the pallet shelter, Shelley said it gives him space to move around and a greater sense of freedom. He came to Chico to participate in the Salvation Army's adult rehabilitation program, which helps participants combat their addictions, build the work and social skills needed to re-enter the workforce. After graduating, he found a job as an equipment operator, met his girlfriend, and was ready to start a new life. But later, he was forced to leave the house he was renting and planned to buy. He injured his back at work, could no longer continue working. He has been homeless for 8 years. Shelley's biggest complaint about the site is the lack of shade. 2 years ago, when the temperature reached 115 degrees, he sat in his wheelchair in the hot sun all day just to prove that nothing could beat him, and he was strong enough to live outside. He also struggled with some of the site's rules. While he understands rules are necessary, he finds them difficult to accept or follow, such as keeping all of his belongings within the 20 by 20 foot space. Now, with Yoon said, instead of the city unilaterally introducing enforcing rules, it would be better if campers could work with the city and nonprofit organizations to discuss and decide rules together. Now, Isaacs, who's 45, said she was unhoused for almost 16 years, ever since her parents kicked her out because of her drug use. She said she's become used to living outdoors after so many years. Quote, I feel like maybe I'm meant to be out here for whatever reason. I could stretch here. Living inside walls is stifling, and especially the pallet shelter because it's very small, and they want you to be in that with your partner and all your animals. Each cabin at Genesis measures roughly 7.5 by 8.5 feet. She called it an above-ground cemetery. She and her boyfriend have 4 dogs, one of which has been with her for almost 16 years. She said she will not give them up in order to enter tourist shelter. It is a congregate shelter where only one pet is allowed for each person. She rarely leaves the site because of the pain of the lymphedema she has, for which she wears wrappings on her legs. In the past, when more people lived at the site, she could ask others to go to the corner store and pick things up for her. She's working on her Social Security disability insurance application and worries those benefits will not come through before the site closes. Two new residents had arrived the day the reporter visited in July, and their arrival also triggered speculation, including Isaac's, whether the city still plans to close the site. Isaac's wondered, why would they do that if they're just going to shut this place down? It's like if you don't want your kids to know the Christmas presents, she added. So while the residents still hold hope, the city says it plans to shut down the site, implement new rules at Genesis, like a curfew, and create a service resistance team. That team would build on Chicopee's existing target team, responsible for anti-camping enforcement and outreach to the unhoused. There are also concerns that stricter shelter rules could discourage people from entering Genesis or remove more residents from Genesis, leaving them with no alternative places to go. Councilmember Katie Hawley asked at the May meeting what the city's plan is for residents who remain at the site. She noted some residents have been unable to move into Genesis because they have pets or criminal histories. Now, Amber Abney Bass, CEO of the Jesus Center, said a resident was offered a placement at Genesis, but has not been ready to move because of mental health challenges. Two sites are occupied by three people whose number of pets exceeds the Genesis limit, and another resident, she said, has been difficult to place because of justice-involved issues around that person. She said the Jesus Center's case management team provides services at the site 2 days a week. Quote, our goal is to be able to have all those people on the road to what will come next for them, as opposed to just turning up the lights and wishing them all. Councilmember Addison Winslow asked what the city would do with people who are removed from Genesis for breaking the rules. Gustafson said the service resistance team would offer those individuals help during enforcement operations. I think they'd be ideal candidates for this team to really spend some time or deploy some special attention to try to find them a path forward, Gustafson said. When Winslow asked whether that meant putting people in jail, former city manager Mark Sorensen said all these folks have different stories, different reasons for being in the position they're in, so I don't think we can give a blanket answer. Shelley is also completing the paperwork to apply for SSDI, he told the reporter. He was diagnosed with mental health conditions several years ago, but needs an updated diagnosis to qualify for his benefits. He earns a small amount of money recycling every night and only at night. Two Chinese characters are tattooed on his forearm, with a word that means courage in Mandarin, done by his late girlfriend. His girlfriend had the same two characters tattooed on each other's arms. They chose the word courage to remind each other to keep facing life's challenges, but they wanted the message in private to be tattooed in Mandarin. In a town without many Chinese residents, it became a secret shared only between the two of them. Then their lives unraveled. They lost their home and their steady income, and together drifted into homelessness. 3 years ago, his girlfriend died unexpectedly, leaving him alone with the tattoo they once shared. He said he doesn't know where he will go after the site closes, but he knows he will carry the word courage with him wherever life takes him next. And now we return to the most recent article published August 4th, Emergency Declaration Could Expedite Sweeps. And this article is also written by Yucheng Tang. There was a special meeting of the council on August 3rd, where the council voted 6-1 for an emergency declaration, which could accelerate enforcement of the anti-camping ordinances, specifically in the Lindo Channel area. But it's not clear how quickly enforcement could proceed. That emergency declaration, that city fire, cities. Over the past 3 years, Chico firefighters responded to 831 outdoor fires related to encampments, according to Fire Chief Wes Matroka. More than half of 143 incidents that have occurred this year occurred in major greenway corridors identified as priority wildfire hazard areas. He said, we focus on the Lindo Channel primarily due to the concentrated increase in fire activity in the area, dense fuel, and the critical exposure to residential neighborhoods. Assistant City Manager Eric Gustafson said there are 15 encampments in the Lindo Channel, and the city initiated the notification process for them to leave last week. He also said the emergency declaration allows the council to direct all city departments to prioritize fire prevention and suppression activities in the area, including accelerating enforcement of the anti-camping ordinances. The one dissenting vote came from Councilmember Bryce Goldstein. She said she wanted to ensure the city's response did not simply push unhoused people into other neighborhoods, and argued for tangible action, such as opening additional pallet shelters or creating another alternative site. Councilmember Tom Van Overbeck asked whether, if approved, there could be an immediate encampment clearing. Gustafson said he does not believe the emergency declaration will completely circumvent the still active Warren-Vichico settlement agreement. Gustafson said he does think it gives some momentum to clearing Kamets. Councilmember Michael O'Brien later asked City Attorney Ryan Jones whether the emergency declaration would supersede any portion of the settlement agreement, and Jones said they weren't going to contravene the Warren settlement, which, again, doesn't expire until January 2027. Emergency declarations, he said, provide the city with new avenues and abilities to address things in a more immediate way to protect people. The primary legal question, he added, was not whether the situation constitutes an emergency, but what type of enforcement actions can legally follow. So he will work closely with the fire chief, code enforcement staff, and other officials to ensure the city adheres to the settlement. And Councilmember Addison Winslow said the city must protect the rights of unhoused residents. Winslow said, I just want to make abundantly clear, no matter how urgent we feel, we can't make people just disappear. We have the settlement agreement. We also have just the laws of physics and human rights that exist. We cannot banish people from the city of Chico. Winslow tried to introduce an amendment after the vote that would direct staff to loosen the assessment criteria so vacant pallet shelters could be used, or direct people to the alternative site during enforcement. That amendment was not included in the resolution. It fell outside the scope of the agenda item. Much of the discussion centered on two main questions: whether the city should focus only on the Lindo Channel corridor or consider fire risk in other areas, and whether addressing the needs of unhoused residents should be part of the city's long-term fire prevention strategy. Councilmember Dale Bennett, whose district encompasses most of the Lindo Channel area, said his friends and neighbors in the area are very concerned about the fire hazards and repeatedly asked him to do something. He agreed the city needs to look at a broader picture when it comes to fire prevention, but also said Lindo Channel's problem should be solved first. Today, this morning, we're talking about Lindo Channel, so let's make a decision about Lindo Channel, and we can look at the rest of this and the situation we have with the fire danger in Chico, hopefully soon. After the meeting, Ashley Michelle Arnold, Communications Director for Safe Space Chico, told Chico Cell she believes emergency declarations like this one are reactive rather than responsive to broader issues surrounding housing and public health. Arnold said a responsive policy would expand upon the points raised by both Councilmembers Goldstein and Winslow, and also acknowledge we cannot ignore the need, which includes those who are unhoused, to be able to cook and shelter safely. Now, these concerns around Lindo Channel have been repeated for years and years. This is not a new issue. This is something that was talked about even before the settlement agreement existed. The fact that people do often return to Lindo Channel even after being removed by city officials has been discussed for a long time. And it's hard to not also keep in mind the timeliness of this, as we just passed the 2-year anniversary of the park fire when it began to burn down many structures in Chico, and the fact that just a couple weeks ago, Ronnie Stout was found guilty of malicious arson for starting the park fire. It burned down over 400,000 acres and 700 structures. And I'm sure that that does live large in people's mindfulness and awareness of fire hazards and just how close those fires can be. But at the same time, it's important to note that we take caution when we use language around fires which are used by unhoused residents and how those fires can spread, especially when we look at what's taken place in other cities. We'll be right back. Peace and Social Justice is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by the Cascade Theater in Reading. Tickets and details for all shows at cascadetheater.org and at 530-243-8877. And by Dr. Mac, your traveling Apple product expert. Dr. Mac trains you to maximize all your Apple products with setup, data transfer, troubleshooting, and repairs, including updates and malware removal. Kevin Mallory is Dr. Mac, the technical doctor who still makes house calls, and he also does remote assistance. You can find Dr. Mac on Facebook at Dr. Mac Help or at 530-386-2616. And back to our program. In our final segment here, I just want to talk about data centers. And I want to note first that what happened this week at the Butte County Water Commission was very interesting. Basically, what happened at the August 5th meeting, where many people attended to voice their concern about a possible data center in the area, where the commission said no data center has yet been proposed in incorporated areas, reflects a growing national concern. So the commission, which is an advisory board to the Board of Supervisors, had a presentation from the County Development Services to understand zoning and permitting related to data centers. The county's jurisdiction over data centers is only for unincorporated areas, and apparently the towns of Chico or Avon Paradise haven't received inquiries for data centers either, based on a Chico Civil Public Records request. But many people still came to the meeting, standing in opposition to the development of these centers. Now, many who have been paying attention to what's going on in other cities, including in Pittsburgh, California, and even other parts of Northern California know, data centers are being proposed and even already began being built across the country. And there's also a swiftly growing political opposition movement to it. There's this Politico article released August 1st by Aaron Mack and Jesse Blazer saying, the companies that build and run data centers are on the losing end of a backlash, and they're struggling to respond. The article notes that server-packed data hubs will drive up electricity prices. There are fears that they'll deplete water supplies and gobble farmland up. And people across the country have packed meetings of zoning boards and county commissions, just like in Butte County, to oppose these projects. The opposition has become a really big problem for this industry that wants to develop an estimated 1,500 data centers, in large part to support the growth of artificial intelligence. So that means there's also been a growing opposition to the fact that artificial intelligence, the generative side, really does seem to create a great problem for those who are very concerned about water use, electricity prices, availability of land, access, especially for the most disproportionately affected people, historically marginalized groups, who are already very much at the most vulnerability, we could say, from climate change, from the impacts of water depletion, declining water supplies, and declining land access as well. The data center companies, Politico said, have tried to sell their projects as a boon to tax revenues and employment, but they often fail to actively communicate with the public, according to tech industry policy advocates and executives. So that messaging voice lets critics gain the upper hand. Results this month from Politico poll reveal the scope of the industry's predicament. Majorities of Americans across the country now are on the side of key arguments from industry opponents. That's changed from just 6 months ago, when many Americans were either undecided or disagreed with the key statements of the opposition. Builders and operators' PR problems mirror larger travails of the artificial intelligence industry's giants, including SpaceX, OpenAI, and Meta. Their efforts to win over messaging in the political battle over data centers and AI have already faced headwinds at the ballot box, and also many negative headlines and legal woes, which have intensified over the last year. We also have news from CNBC that Representative Ro Khanna, a Democrat in California, is introducing what he calls a data center bill of rights, looking at the nationwide voter recoiling from potential utility rate hikes by facilities that power artificial intelligence. Khanna is widely expected to run for president in 2028, by the way. He said the resolution would give local communities the right to say no to data centers. He said he heard feedback on data centers when he recently traveled to Pennsylvania. He told CNBC, quote, the biggest feedback I heard was an opposition to data centers across the state. We need a data center bill of rights where communities don't have these data centers shoved down their throat, where they can stand up and say no, where they can make sure these aren't going in farmland or residential communities. The resolution would establish a set of rights for local communities to reject data center construction. It comes amid a crush of other legal efforts to slow data center development over concerns they will add to the already very high cost of living, especially in states like California. Those authorities Khanna proposes include empowering communities to bar data centers from being built within 2,500 feet of homes, schools, childcare facilities, hospitals, or nursing homes. It would ensure the ability to reject any proposed data center through a transparent community process and maintain a state's ability to adopt statewide pauses on new data centers until the state approves protections that stop ratepayers from rising electricity bills and prevent the draining of local water supplies, both of which are major, major concerns in California and have been for years. Several states, including New York, already implemented moratoriums on data centers. The resolution, if approved, would also preserve the ability of communities and municipalities to regulate data center development without being preempted. States require data centers to use clean and reliable energy and meet pollution limits. rates and allow communities to demand utility bills to not increase. Data centers have already been facing a political reckoning across the U.S., this article notes, and the midterm elections will determine who controls Congress for the remainder of President Trump's term, including who controls policy around these centers. The buildings have repelled voters due to their massive energy and water demand. And data center opponents have been recently winning big at the polls, including Michigan Democratic Senate candidate Abdul El-Sayed, who won a competitive primary Tuesday, and who was endorsed by Khanna. Khanna represents Silicon Valley, and he said the hyperscalers building data centers are, quote, losing the country. This has been the Peace and Social Justice Show. I really appreciate everyone who tunes in and supports not just local journalism and community reporting, but also community discussions and sharing information, especially information about surveillance, about data centers, and in general issues that concern especially the people who would be most impacted immediately, is important to our work. And it also just shows that there's a great concern for our community members, for our broader citizens. And I just appreciate that people in Chico are so active. People across Butte County are so focused on the things that affect everyone and want to get that out there. It's hard to find a city and county that are as engaged as this one is. And I'm just really grateful to be from here and to continue doing this work with all of you. And we appreciate your support as well of community local radio to make this programming possible. We will see you in September. Have a safe August. Say.
I'm Robert Jones, one of the hosts of the Peace and Social Justice Show, a program where you will learn of inspiring social justice work being done by people locally, nationally, and around the globe. Many of the segments I produce revolve around the plight of Chico's most vulnerable and demonized population, the poor and unhoused. I also focus on issues of animal rights and animal justice. Tune into Peace and Social Justice every Friday at 11:30, right here on KZFR 90.1 FM, Chico.
And Peace and Social Justice ended a little early today. Big T on this Friday for Plain Dead. Hope all is well out there in Radio Land. We're going to visit a show going back a ways. Back to August the 12th of 1972, the Sacramento Memorial Auditorium. Got a few minutes before the top of the hour when we'll listen to the calendar. Until then, I was going to tell you about an event coming up down in San Francisco, beginning on September the 5th, and it's called the Forever Grateful Golden Gate Park, and it will be an exhibition of art, multimedia, projections, hands-on. The Further bus will be there. And the show will have a concert, a free concert, from 2 to 6 p.m. at the Robin Williams Meadow. And that will be headlined by Graham Lesh and friends. And then the exhibit will last until the end of, close to the end of September, I believe. So it's going to be a wonderful event. The music will be on Monday, September 7th. And it will involve, it will have like over 400 paintings and lithographs, instruments. And it'll be just a wonderful celebration of the Deadhead community and the Grateful Dead's relationship to Golden Gate Park. So let's look forward to that. This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. We are at the top of the hour. Let's find out what's going on, and then we'll kick off some music from back in 1972.
You're listening to 90.1 KZFR Chico,